April the 4th. Key issues on the agenda include the three P's: promotion, protection, and prevention. Promotion of human rights, protection of those who fight for human rights, and preventing human rights from being violated. Gisumisha Ahmadi, the Human Rights Headquarters in Geneva.
Years after Brexit, they're still talking about it. One big sticking point, the post-Brexit Northern Ireland Protocol for Trade, legislation that at one point threatened the Good Friday Peace Agreement and pushed the EU and UK to the brink of a trade war. Officials on both sides of the dispute now claim they have found a solution to the problem, and they have a name for it too.
The Windsor Framework delivers free-flowing trade within the whole United Kingdom. It protects Northern Ireland's place in our union, and it safeguards sovereignty for the people of Northern Ireland.
Under the new deal, there will be two routes for goods entering Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK. A green route with minimal checks for goods, which will stay in Northern Ireland, and a red one for goods which may continue into the EU after going through EU checks. Disputes will be settled by Northern Ireland courts, but some could still go to the European Court of Justice. And if new EU single market regulations are introduced, the UK government could veto them if the Northern Ireland Assembly has voted for that to happen.
We are now seeing part of the United Kingdom, namely the north of Ireland, essentially being re-invited back into aspects of the EU. And that is a very big statement. And I'm sure that Brussels is hoping this will begin to disintegrate the overall Brexit deal.
The details of the deal are yet to emerge, but Prime Minister Sunak faces two challenges. One is to get the approval of the Democratic Unionists in Northern Ireland, who have refused to enter a power-sharing government with Sinn Féin nationalists for months over the Boris Johnson-era protocol, which has created a sea border between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK.
The Unionists have a set of tests that have to be passed or they'll back out of it. Now, that's an insurance policy. They don't want to lose votes. They don't want to look like they've sold out the Unionist agenda. And that makes political sense for them. The big test for Sunak, more than anything else, is whether he can get all sides to give a tick in the box.
In Westminster, meantime, the Prime Minister has briefed his cabinet, who seem to be on side.
The Prime Minister's next challenge would be winning the approval of the Eurosceptic Conservative members of the ERG, the European Research Group in the building behind me, who have already said that the revised bill does not go far enough, which means that the deal is not quite done yet. Saeed Purza, London.
The indefinite strike, which began nationwide on January 4th in protest at the Dina Boluarte administration, remains strong in the southern regions of Peru, with major road closures in several provinces, according to the Ground Transport Authority. Nearly all of the civilians that have been reported killed since the December 7th ouster of President Castillo lost their lives in anti-government protests in this part of the country.
It's mainly the people in the countryside who are mistreated. We cry daily for our sons who have been killed, as many as 70 people by this government, and they still haven't acknowledged that they did it. They haven't said who was killed.
A newly released Ipsos poll finds that nationally, 51% of Peruvians believe that Pedro Castillo was ousted in a parliamentary coup, a number which surges to 69% in rural areas like here in the Puno region.
Particularly in Puno, they have marginalized us a lot. They have said that we are terrorists, that we are vandals, and that we are just Indians. We are going to continue fighting. I believe this strike will continue until Dina Boluarte resigns, as well as the rest of the Congress.
A preliminary report released this week by the International Human Rights and Solidarity Mission outlines numerous human rights abuses and calls for an investigation of the Peruvian state for crimes against humanity, for its excessive use of force against a defenseless civilian population and using lethal weapons.
I want justice to be served and for the whole world to find out everything that we are going through here. I want everyone to know so that there is justice for our children who have died.
Around the country, the popular call continues to be the demand for the resignation of Dina Boluarte, as well as immediate presidential elections. Camila Escalante, Desaguadero.
Consumer Association Feder Consumatori has rung the alarm bell over the growing financial difficulties Italian families are faced with. Feder Consumatori National Observatory has found that one out of four families in Italy is struggling to cope with high inflation and rising cost of living. This, as the Bureau of Statistics Istat has estimated, a timid comeback in consumer confidence in February. According to Feder Consumatori, an increasing number of Italians are giving up on food quality to save money.
Today, as the cost of living crisis has eroded families' purchasing power, we have recorded a 17% drop in the purchase of meat and fish and a 13% drop in the consumption of fruit and vegetables. We had asked the government to introduce significant supporting measures for the Italian families, but unfortunately our calls went utterly unheard.
Prices in Italy rose more than 8% year on year in 2022, jumping to its highest 12-month gain in nearly 40 years when the lira currency was in use. According to Istat, Italy's annual inflation rate registered a slowdown in January, dropping to 10% from 11.6% in December. However, the situation has turned dire for many in the country.
The cost of living went up big way, too much for a young student like me. Prices have doubled over the past months.
The cost of staple food items, basic ingredients, has gone crazy, and also the cost of energy. To me, it's a theft by the government.
According to analysts, high energy prices have been the main drivers for the bulk of those increases, pushed higher by the energy supply challenges that followed the Ukraine-Russia war. The poverty rate increased significantly in Italy in 2020-2022 period. In 2021, some 2 million families lived in absolute poverty, a figure accounting for over 5.5 million people that is destined to grow. Max Civili, Rome.
Egypt's Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. In the meeting, the top diplomat conveyed Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's message of solidarity to Assad and all Syrians affected by the recent earthquakes. He also expressed Cairo's keenness on bolstering historic relations between Syria and Egypt, as well as boosting joint cooperation. Assad, for his part, thanked Egypt for sending humanitarian assistance, asserting that improving bilateral ties among Arab states constitute the foundation for improving the situation in general in the Arab world. Shoukry stressed that Egypt-Syria relations are a basic factor in the security of Arab countries. He also reiterated his country's support for Syria.
Egypt has offered so far 1,500 tons of assistance and will continue to provide all humanitarian assistance needed. Relations between both nations are strong. Egypt supports Syria in facing challenges. We hope Syria overcomes the repercussions of the earthquakes as soon as possible.
Shoukry also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart, in which Faisal al-Maqdad briefed him on the steps taken by the Syrian government for helping Syrians affected by the earthquakes. Al-Maqdad also thanked Egypt for its unwavering aid to Syrians since day one of the earthquakes.
We welcome Egypt's foreign minister, who is visiting his home, people and country. His talks with President Assad focused on the results of the earthquakes and the historic relations between both countries. Egypt played a significant role in assisting Syrians following the earthquakes.
The visit comes a day after a historic trip by several senior lawmakers of Arab parliaments to Damascus, who affirmed they will push their governments for restoring relations with Syria. That's amid an increase in such moves by Arab states. This is the first visit for an Egyptian foreign minister to Syria since the start of the crisis in 2011. It's a clear indication of Egypt's serious intention to gradually restore normal ties with the Arab country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Tomatoes, one of your five a day. Supermarket giants in the UK are now only allowing three of these and other salad ingredients to their customers. And where there is availability, you'll have to pay a premium, especially when it comes to out-of-season fresh produce. Here is why.
Starting with climate change, 2022 was the second hottest year in Europe. Heat waves and extreme temperatures in Spain, one of Europe's biggest food producers, have meant fewer crops to harvest. The same problem with supplying countries such as Morocco in North Africa. But the UK has its own well-established food industry. One important component of it, greenhouses, many hectares of which now lay barren.
There is a problem, of course, with the high price of gas that is used to heat up these greenhouses. They do require quite a lot of gas input, and that's quite expensive. And the problem is that the supermarkets are also being very tough on pricing. So it's not easy to then raise your prices and get what you want from the supermarkets. And so rather than produce anything at a loss, some producers have obviously decided not to produce at all.
And the UK faces another particular issue. Most of its fruit and veg come from the European Union. The country's exit from the bloc has meant extra costs and bureaucracy added to the strain, especially on the supply of perishable goods.
Brexit has caused a shortage of labour, and a shortage of labour means a shortage of fruit and vegetables at the end of the day. More bureaucracy, and more bureaucracy means more costs, and more costs mean less profits, and therefore lower UK production. It's as simple as that.
The solution, food-producing organizations say, is for the government to provide more support, such as replacing high-carbon fertilizers with low-carbon alternatives, or investing more in soil-free indoor growing techniques, such as vertical farming. Saeed Purza, London.
The first memorial of Martyrs of Resistance Media, entitled Narrators of Resistance, has been held in the Iranian capital, Tehran. The families of media martyrs from Iran, Iraq, Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan, Palestine, and Lebanon attended the event. Addressing the ceremony, the commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Quds Force, Brigadier General Ismail Ghani, praised the Martyrs of Resistance Media as a treasure which must be well invested.
The media presence of our martyrs makes them convey the sublime values that led them to achieve the goal of martyrdom. The global arrogance led by the U.S. promotes that those who own money and the biggest weapons are to emerge victorious in wars. However, despite its limited capabilities, the media of the resistance front succeeded in conveying the voice of truth.
Moreover, speaking at the event, head of the IRIB, Dr. Jebeli, honored the media martyrs on the resistance front.
In hard war, the enemy seeks to destroy our fortifications and force us to retreat from one place to another. But in soft war, the enemy does not use weapons, bombardment, and physically does not seek to push us back from one area to another, but seeks to mislead us, change our thinking, distort reality, and take us away from the straight path. We proudly pay for our resistance, but I would like to say that resistance not only costs nothing, but is a total investment. The participants believe that along with the war launched against the axis of resistance in the military sphere, the U.S. and the Zionist regime have also been using all means in the media sphere to undermine the resistance.
The participants believe that along with the war launched against the axis of resistance in the military sphere, the U.S. and the Zionist regime have also been using all means in the media sphere to undermine the resistance. Journalists of resistance media, as the narrators of resistance and truth, shed light on the realities on the ground in conflict zones, the realities which have been repeatedly ignored by mainstream media outlets of the West, led by the United States. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Palestinians in Gaza, including resistance factions, non-governmental organizations, academics, as well as civil society groups, held a national conference on Sunday to condemn the Aqaba summit. The meeting between Israeli and the Palestinian Authority officials was held in the Jordanian Red Sea Resort of Aqaba. It was also attended by representatives from the United States and Egypt. The spokesman for Hamas resistance movement said that the Aqaba summit aims to cover up the Israeli regime's ongoing crimes against the Palestinian people.
The Aqaba Security Summit will only harm the Palestinian cause and aims to abort the simmering uprising in the West Bank and Al-Quds. The participation of the Palestinian Authority in this summit only indicates the resumption of security cooperation with the occupying regime. We call on all countries to hold an international conference to support the rights of the Palestinian people.
The summit comes only days after Israeli regime forces killed around a dozen Palestinians and wounded some 90 others in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. In its final communique, the conference in Gaza stressed the importance of increasing all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation and protecting occupied Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque against all Israeli plots.
All forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation all over Palestine are legitimate and will continue to increase despite all conspiracies and challenges. We also warn the Israeli regime against playing with fire and violating the sanctity of Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians maintain that the Aqaba summit aims to sow seeds of division among Palestinians and to suppress resistance groups in the occupied West Bank.
The Aqaba meeting, which is going to be held today with the sponsorship of the Americans, Egypt, Jordan, and that will include Israel and the Palestinian Authority, is intended, in my opinion, to resume security coordination between the Palestinian Authority and Israel. And also, I think it's intended to crack down on Palestinian resistance.
Many Palestinians believe that the Palestinian Authority has become a haven for small Palestinian factions that have long abandoned the path of resistance against the Israeli occupation. Since the start of this year, over 60 Palestinians, including 13 children, have been killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Analysts say the Aqaba summit will only give Tel Aviv the green light to kill and maim more Palestinians. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately, to help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive, to let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the most merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Another missile test by North Korea. Four long-range cruise missiles were fired. A repeated scenario in response to U.S. joint war games. But is this time different? North Korea says it is, and the U.S. and its regional allies believe these missiles are being developed with the intent to arm them with nuclear warheads. In this edition of the program, we will look at why the U.S. is ramping up military pressure instead of diplomatic overtures on Pyongyang, and why it is content in doing that, knowing that North Korean missiles are capable of reaching the U.S. mainland. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. William Jones from the Executive Intelligence Review joins us from Leesburg. Jim Cavan, a political analyst and blogger, joins us from New York. To welcome you both, and William Jones, let me first start with you. First, get your reaction on the missiles that were fired. We're looking at four long-range cruise missiles. The question is whether this time is different based on how the capabilities, as it was reported, it said these were strategic cruise missiles designed to demonstrate its ability to conduct a nuclear counterattack. The key word being counterattack here, I think. So do you deem this to be different than the previous missile launches?
Well, they're obviously improving their capabilities here. Reports have it that some of the missiles had made an oval and even a double-eight maneuver, showing that there is a greater maneuverability in these missiles. And, of course, they're reaching now to almost 2,000 kilometers. It's really a serious upgrade on the part of North Korea. And as the situation becomes more tense, directly after the maneuvers between Japan, South Korea, and the U.S., where the U.S. is doing significant upgrading in the Asia-Pacific region generally, aimed at North Korea, but also against China, this has created a great deal of tension where the North Koreans typically react by trying to show some of their capabilities. So I think there is an increased tension, there's increased capability that North Korea is now showing, but I think they're doing it in a context in which the tensions are being fed by U.S. policy in the region, which is increasingly more pushing the military rather than diplomatic solution to the problem, especially the problems with the DPRK.
So you're seeing a relationship there between the U.S. militaristic approach towards the region and the number of missiles or the times the missiles are being launched by North Korea?
Well, sure. I'm sure they are trying to utilize the the maximum capability that they actually have there. I think this probably would not have occurred had the maneuvers not taken place. And the maneuvers, of course, are directly aimed at at North Korea and have been criticized by North Korea prior to their being held in the area, so that it was a direct affront, I think they felt, to their attempt to maintain some kind of stability in the region. And they're reacting in the way that DPR always reacts.
Jim Kavanaugh, taking a look at the joint war games that was reported on this between the U.S. and South Korea, what was different about this is the fact that it was held in Washington, and basically they called it a tabletop exercise, which focused on, I guess, hypothetical scenarios of which North Korea would use nuclear weapons. And this was the first of its sort under the South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol. Is that what is that indicative of, or what does that show, that it was practiced in the U.S.?
I'm not sure that shows very much. The United States and South Korea have engaged in real military exercises, and that's what really annoys the North Koreans. It was a tabletop exercise in Washington. Of course, it's presented as a defensive exercise, but of course, even in the middle of a defensive exercise, they're going to plan for an invasion of North Korea, and North Korea knows that. So it's just a fact of the military cooperation and the tight military cooperation between South Korea and the United States going to Washington to do these exercises that has North Korea on edge. Look, everybody has to understand the history of the Korean War, which is kind of a forgotten war. That was a vicious war. The United States bombed North Korea to rubble, and they did that to prevent the unification of the peninsula under the forces that had fought the Japanese, which was a vicious Japanese occupation. And they did that in support of a dictatorial regime in the south, which was composed of people who had collaborated with the Japanese. So the North Koreans have a history. They know, they have a historical memory of what it means for the United States to attack them. And that's why they're on edge all the time about this. So, you know, they're never going to stop being on edge about North Korean, South Korean, United States military exercises and military cooperation and building up forces. And now the United States is building up Japan again to be, Joe Biden vowed to make Japan a potent military force. You know, again, the Japanese occupation of Korea was vicious. So the North Koreans have a historical memory that most people in the West, you know, the Korean War was glossed over in our history, and not for them. So they remember this, and they're going to be on edge about any American military exercises in the region. And they know what's going on with China and Taiwan. They know that even NATO has said, we've got to extend our reach into the Pacific. For some reason, the Pacific's part of the North Atlantic now. So there's a world situation, and in that area too, which is on the edge of conflict. Sure. And the Americans seem to be ready for conflict everywhere, and the North Koreans are aware of that.
There's a number of points that you raised there. Before we get to those points, however, I got to find out whether we can zoom in, William Jones, on who goes first. I'm trying to figure this out based on the way things are being reported. I mentioned what's happening in the States with this tabletop exercises, but this is an exercise held where the U.S. has announced that this is being done because of a potential nuclear strike by North Korea. Okay? They're looking at it that way. But the North's posturing is one of counterattack, meaning the U.S. or its allies would attack first. Is that accurate, reading it that way? And then there's this the fact that this does not read with how each stands in terms of attacking first, because each thinks the other is going to attack first.
Well, I think that's probably they would be wary of trying to start a nuclear conflict with the United States of their own volition. Since they realize there's going to be perhaps a destruction of the nation. But they must have that capability. The reason they're going with a nuclear, becoming a nuclear power, effectively becoming a nuclear power, is that they feel that there's no other option open to them. that the opposition of the United States to the DPRK has been pretty straightforward through the years. The only exception was when President Trump successfully conducted negotiations with North Korea. People felt that it could be resolved diplomatically. But he was heavily criticized by the military-industrial complex while he was still president, while this was still ongoing. And then afterwards, of course, has been totally rejected by the Biden administration, which feels that only a policy of showing force, peace through strength, can make any headway with regard to the DPR. Of course, that causes the major conflict. So that they see these as the nuclear capability that they have as a capability of being able to fend off and to respond to a possible nuclear attack from the West. But they do it by showing what they can do, because words are not going to convince anybody in the U.S. military-industrial complex that North Korea is not a threat unless it shows that it is. And this is why they're very demonstrative in showing the weapons, rather than pursuing an aggressive policy. They want to show that we can respond,
okay,
and you should do this with some respect, and you should try and come to some kind of a negotiated position with us. But at this point, it just has not succeeded because of the tremendous opposition to the United States of diplomacy in the DPRK-U.S. relationship.
So your guess, yes or no answer, if I may ask you that, William Jones, based on how you see it, if the situation continues this way, who would strike first?
Well, I do not think that the DPRK would make any first strike unless they were significantly threatened, or they felt that they were significantly threatened.
Well, they're feeling that right now, right?
Well, that's a real question. What is the red line here? I mean,
I tell you why they're feeling that. Let me throw this stat out there. You have all the different missile tests that have happened. I'm going to address Jim Kavanaugh with this. Jim Kavanaugh, you have all these missile tests that North Korea has executed throughout the years, and then boom, 2020. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't use that word. Then you have the year 2022, and you have 72 of them. You had 22 missile tests in a span of 3 days. I think they're feeling threatened, or they're trying to say something. What do you think? What do you make of that? And this happening during the tenure of the current U.S. President Joe Biden?
Well, I think they are trying to demonstrate that if we get hit, we can impose serious damage on those who come after us. Look, they have certain problems with this. They did demonstrate some maneuvering capabilities with these cruise missiles, but they're still saying they're not yet capable of carrying nuclear weapons. The nuclear weapons, ballistic missiles they have are still liquid fuel missiles, which means they cannot be readied very quickly. The United States knows what's happening there. If North Korea were to start fueling up their ICBMs for an attack on someone, the United States would know it.
Can
they? I think so, probably, because they're liquid-fueled missiles. They require preparation. They can't be easily moved around.
Why not push for some kind of diplomatic move, something, a concession maybe of some kind? I'm guessing when you have missiles that can reach the U.S. mainland, and you say that maybe it could be capable of nuclear warhead, which the reading was by the U.S., that this is a rehearsal for developing nuclear warheads or putting nuclear warheads on it, you would guess there'd be some kind of diplomatic overture. Why isn't there one?
Well, I don't think, is the American administration ready to have a diplomatic overture with North Korea? Because it doesn't want to, they could put in, this, the Korean War is still going on. There's no peace treaty.
William Jones, what do you think?
The United States doesn't want
William
to put it
Let me get
it.
William
Donald
Jones
Trump
an answer on this. I'm sorry, Jim Kavanaugh. William Jones, why not?
Nobody can say for sure what the North Korean leadership's decisions will be in this. There's a lot of erratic movement. There's a lot of irrationalism. However, I think it's quite clear to them that if they would launch a strike against the United States, or even a strike against the United States facilities like in Guam, or perhaps even a strike against Japan, there would probably be an overwhelming reaction by U.S. nuclear forces, which would essentially end the North Korean state entirely. I think there's a certain understanding of that. And therefore, I think that they would be very reticent in starting that fight. But at the same time, they want to have the capability for a variety of reasons, for defense reasons, but also in terms of the political influence that being a nuclear power has in the world, which they also want to attain. But I think short of that, I think that if they launched an attack, it would be like a hand grenade that would be set off in North Korea itself, ending the North Korean state. Mm-hmm. I don't think the North Korean leadership, as mercurial as they are, is totally insane on this issue.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right. Well, you both have mentioned Japan on a couple of occasions now, so let's look at the military defense budget. It has been raised by 26%. That's the largest. What does that mean when it comes to what Jim Kavanaugh, what you said? You said that the U.S. is going to be pumping them up with arms. First of all, does Japan want to really get in on this with the U.S.? Is Japan acting on its own free will when it comes to the way that it stands with North Korea?
Well, I think there are political factions in Japan that want to rearm, that would like Japan to become a potent military force, quote unquote, in the region again. And they are de facto, the United States is promoting that and doing that, and they will do it. Now, it's not just in relation to Korea, but it's in relation to the region as a whole. And, you know, again, it is very, the peculiarity of the North Korean situation is unique. And again, Japan's relationship with Korea is terrible. And historically, you know, I don't think they're looking to reinvade and reoccupy Korea, but they are part of the American hegemonic domination of the Pacific region. And that's what they've thrown in their lot, like Europe has thrown in its lot, Western Europe and Eastern Europe with the United States and Europe. Japanese have thrown in their lot with the Americans, and we are going to be part of your hegemonic program in the Pacific region, which means we're going to support whatever you do in China and whatever you do in North Korea.
Okay, since you mentioned China, need to ask you about that, Bill Jones. What is the relationship between China and North Korea?
The relationship is still a friendly relationship. I don't think they have control over what North Koreans do. They have some influence. But I think they're also very wary and uncertain about where that's going. They would like to have a diplomatic resolution to the nuclear issue. They do want a nuclear-free Korean peninsula. They would like to see this moving forward, but they are not the chief players there. And as long as there is no indication from the United States to achieve such a solution, they have very little they can do. The issue of North Korea, of course, is also, in one sense, defensive for them, because the fact that the North Koreans are there as a former ally and still a very good friend, a lot of trade relations between the two, this is also preserves a buffer in many respects against Japan in particular, which is becoming more hostile, at least in the defense area. And even South Korea, which still maintains very good relationships with China, but is also being wooed by the United States to join in some kind of alliance, perhaps of a military character, aimed against China. So the China's position is that they would like to see a stable DPRK. They would like to see some kind of diplomatic solution to this. They would use their influence, I believe, if the United States were willing to move in that direction. But they do not want a military conflict on the Korean Peninsula, okay, because this would be very disastrous.
Jim Cavanaugh, I asked you about the number of missile launches that North Korea did in the year 2022, which was the most, 70, compared to the previous years. Now, there's one theory that says North Korea has upped its number of missile exercises because it's also wanting to send a message, but not of the direct kind, to the U.S., because it shows that what the U.S. intentions in the region are, aside from doing something about North Korea, is to target China. So with these exercises increasing to the point that it has, this may make the U.S. think twice about a military engagement in the region. Do you think that's the type of message that North Korea has sent to the U.S.? Does the U.S. see it that way?
Well, I'm sure the U.S. does see it that way, in the sense that the U.S. would like to know that there's no side action here that's going to come from North Korea if they get into a conflict with China, which very well might happen. And by the fact of doing all this test, and I think the main reason North Korea is doing all the testing is because it's doing a lot of development of new weapon systems, and it wants to make sure they work, and it wants to demonstrate to the world that they work. But the side effect of that is that it puts the United States in a position of having to think twice about. That's why the United States would like to get rid of this North Korean issue before they take on China in any way. I'm sure they'd like to do that, like they want to get rid of Syria and Iran, you know, Syria and Libya before they take on Iran. So there's a lot of things going on in that respect. But, you know, the main reason the North Koreans are doing it, I think, is because they want to develop their systems, and they need to develop their systems, which aren't completely developed. And the United States does need to worry, at least, you know, what we have to take account if we're going to have military action with China. Will the North Koreans come in, and will their missiles be part of the package that we have to deal with in such a conflict?
All right. Final question. Unfortunately, I have so many, but final question, Bill Jones, goes to you. This is an odd request, to say the least, when the U.S. holds China responsible for North Korea's multiple missile launches. It's even asked China and Russia to pressure North Korea to stop. I mean, really? Do you think that the U.S. even... Well, I mean, hey, you got to give it to the U.S. You know, they're asking what they cite as a number one and two national security threats to please do us a favor and stop North Korea from launching these missiles. How do you view that U.S. request from both China and Russia? In under a minute, please.
Well, why would they help the United States in any sense in this issue, when Russia, of course, is under attack by the United States, and where China has been a target of hostility from the U.S., in which the Taiwan issue is now being played with? It's not a situation in which you have a whole lot of trust between these countries.
Okay.
In other circumstances, perhaps there would be cooperation if you're working towards like a security architecture in the Asia Pacific. They would work together. But to the extent that the U.S. has named Russia an enemy and also China as an enemy, you're not going to get too many favors out of them.
Indeed. Thank you very much for that. William Jones, Executive Intelligence Review from Leesburg. Jim Cavanaugh, political analyst and blogger from New York. Thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tahwei and the team, it's goodbye.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. History of Knowledge in Iran. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Most historians believe that the great bulk of progresses in human sciences and civilization is indebted to the Iranian scientists and civilization. As it was said in the previous episode of this series, UNESCO had dubbed last year as the International Year of Basic Sciences for Sustainable Development, that is IYBSSD 2022, to mark the importance and role of sciences in human life. Please stay with us for the second part of this series. Perhaps you have noticed that some powers, regimes, and governments make serious effort to divide nations and ethnicities into civilized and uncivilized ones. They try to change history and even names of places, events, and persons so that the nationality of a scientist or a scholar is not recognized easily. At times, these powers and regimes totally deny the move and endeavor of a nation or people toward progress and growth. Such unfair efforts began in 17th and 18th centuries and continue to date. If we consider knowledge as conscious dealing with nature, we will accept that mankind has always lived with knowledge. In other words, the man who lived nearly 100,000 years ago used to try hard for a better life. Current sciences, including math, are the result of the whole mankind all over the planet. Different peoples in different ages were in different levels of civilization and, relying on their intellect and experiences, intended to discover the laws of nature to have a better life. Basic mathematical concepts like quantity and shape have always been with man, and generally speaking, math has had a life as long as man. Math, however, didn't mean the science of numbers in the ancient worlds, but it was quite tangible in buildings, water structures, tools, and equipment. For instance, the rules of math can clearly be seen in the construction of Achaemenid palaces, mapping and making of the means of transportation, such as ships and chariots. Some of the mathematical principles and rules, such as algebra tables and equations, were quite common in the ancient Shush or Susa in southwestern Iran. The devising of measurement units by Iranian mathematicians spread these concepts to vast areas of those days. The remnants of that era indicate that Iranians were notably aware of geometry. Many Greek scientists benefited from Iranians in this field. Pythagoras, as a founder of geometry, registered Pythagoras' theorem in his name after his journey to the East and benefiting from the Iranian scientists. This is while historical documents bear witness that the geometricians of Shush knew the theorem well, but they had failed to present it publicly. Thank you. In the 7th and 6th centuries BC, the Iranian culture was transferred to Babylon and North Africa. Iran's cultural contact with Greece was quite common during the 5th and 6th centuries BC. And although Alexander of Macedonia assaulted Iran and devastated many cities and ancient monuments, Iranian culture spread to Greece and the adjoining regions. During the Parthian rule, some of the savants of Seistan, that is eastern Iran, went to India and founded mathematical and astronomical traditions over there. They were known as Magus Brahman. The noted Iranian mathematician Brahma Gupta had apparently remained from those people. Iranians were the founders of algebra and trigonometry. The concept of number was formed in Iran as a variable quantity. Dynamic equations were broadly pursued to put the foundations of non-Euclidean geometry. This was the basic for Western Europe to follow up the endeavor. If we'll have a look at the theoretical aspect of math, we can divide it into four eras, including Era of Formation of Awareness and Mathematical Concepts. Number 2, Era of Elementary Math. Number 3, Era of Math with Variable Quantities. And number 4, Era of Modern Math. Iran passed through the first era till the 7th century AD and stepped in the second era of progress from the end of the 8th century till early 9th century, and entered even the third era in some domains. Of course, with regards to the remaining documents and also archaeological discoveries, this category can change a little. During the first era of math, the concepts of this science were in close relation with people's daily needs. Counting of livestock, division of agricultural lands, establishment of temples and palaces, building of bridges and dams, securing of provision for warriors, and so on. More advanced phases included calculations pertaining to trade, shipping, securing of water needed for agriculture, and digging of kanats, or underground water canals. Naturally, with the start of city dwelling and emergence of powerful states, mathematical methods for solving of problems developed alongside increase of needs. Math was at the service of man in this era. The era of elementary math was the time when concepts and rules became abstract while keeping their relation with the scientific and social needs. The Elamites ruled from 4th century BC in the south and southwest of Iran. Powerful Elamite states ruled vast regions from their capital. They had common borders with Sumerians and then Babylonians and enjoyed the system of slavery like those two neighbors. The close relation of Sumerians with Elamites included broad cultural and commercial dealings and continuous wars and skirmishes. Thus, in some spheres, it is very hard to separate cultural progresses of these two nations. Elamites left such a rich culture through 35 centuries, whose impact has remained in all eras of the Iranian civilization. Although little has remained of the Elamite civilization, the Elamite language and writing was used during the next eras, such as the Pars. Math in Shush, like in the neighboring countries in Mesopotamia, was in close relation with people's routine needs. Few mathematical texts that have been found from Shush show that mathematicians of the region were mainly priests and soothsayers who had got access to a kind of numeric system and even many abstract deductions of elementary math. Elamite mathematicians were well acquainted with mathematical rules of triangles and polygons. Although there is little documentary made on progresses in math during 1,200 years, spanning the 6th century BC till 7th century AD, it is obvious from the architecture and artistic works of the era that engineering had remarkably advanced. Astronomy and music, as two sciences closely related with math, climaxed in this era.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.